Okay. I was a child once.
Once. Okay, today is July 11th, 2003, and I am interviewing Wiley McFarland.
So here I am, ready to be interviewed.
When and where were you born?
I was born in Dodge City, actually, but that's right at this area.
Mm-hmm. And when was that?
1928.
1928.
May the 12th.
What did your parents do for a living?
They were on this cattle ranch.
Mm-hmm.
So we're right where we were then.
Haven't moved.
Haven't moved.
Do you have any brothers or sisters?
No, I don't have any brothers or sisters. I'm only child.
Mm-hmm. So tell me about what it was like growing up on a ranch. What kind of chores did you do?
Well, it seemed like we were pretty well tied to the place. I mean, there was no going downtown, no going here, there, or anywhere else. And I always liked to tag along. And so as far as definite chores, sometimes we did garden work, and we fed pigs and fed cows and that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
But I always disliked chores, so I still try to keep them to a minimum.
What did you do for fun then?
I don't know that I did a lot of things for fun. I guess I did. When about 1934 or 1935, radio became prevalent, and so you'd listen to the radio quite a bit. I know we have a TV guide now, but back in those days, why, my mother and father, they got a big piece of cardboard, and they would put on the days and the different programs that would be on each week in the day. And so I remember Jack Benny was Sunday evening at 6 o'clock, and Fred Allen was Wednesday evening at 8 o'clock, and you just kind of pointed toward those things. They were kind of a highlight for your week.
Mm-hmm. Did you go down to the river at all, or?
Not much to play, no. Uh-uh. We had a irrigation ditch we developed at 36, and no, we didn't do a lot there playing with things either. It was just a matter of more work than play.
Mm-hmm. So you raised cattle, and then you sold them. Did you have to drive them down to town, or?
Yeah, we did in those days quite a bit. We had one of the first feedlots, I guess you'd say, in the area.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember we fed cattle in 35 and 36 and 37, 38, 39. And each railroad, each town had a stockyards, and that was where the cattle would come in and be loaded off the train if they were coming into the country, or if you were raising your own, why, then you would take them and you'd take them down and put them on a railroad car. I don't remember trucks really hauling cattle much until the mid-40s. Most everything was railroad, and I do remember a few incidents. Of course, we always had to cross the river one way or another. The river did run some then.
Mm-hmm.
And in the winter time is when you would sell your fat cattle. Usually that's when they came out. And if you had ice on the river, that was a little hard to get them to go through it. And if you had quite a bit of water, you took them to the bridge and drove them over the bridge. And then, of course, when you did that, then you were in town with them. And sometimes they would be a little hard to drive down through the streets of town, although you picked your way around, you got along all right. But then you'd get them to the railroad yard, and you'd order so many cars, and they'd put them on the siding, and then you'd have to load them up, and you'd do that. So that's the way we, then after, I suppose, oh, maybe 40, 41, 42, somewhere in there, the truck became the method, and the railroads, well, I think it was basically the railroads couldn't care less. I've often said that if the depot agent down here and the person running the freight, if he'd have gotten even 5% of the money that they charge people to use the railroad, we'd probably be still doing a lot of things that way. But I'll always remember 1936, I think it was, we had relatives in California, and so we went down. My mother would go out some summers and take me along, and so we went down to get some tickets to go on the train. And you'd think we were doing that depot agent a big favor by even being there. He didn't want to open the door, window to sell us a ticket. And you know, and you feel that too. You can say what you want to. I mean, yeah, he did it. Yeah, it'd be all right. Yeah, yeah, yeah. But he wasn't glad you were there. He'd rather you were somewhere else and he was reading his book. So it's kind of, and we face that today too, to an extent.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Nobody really wants to be working.
What?
Nobody really wants to be working.
I don't know about that. But on the other side of it, you better realize that you better be working, and you better be doing it. If you're in the service business, you better be about as good a service as somebody else, or you're not going to survive. And if company's big enough, why, okay, you know, who cares? But if you're a little service, why, I think a classic example maybe is the drugstore down here. I mean, they go out of their way to try to serve you and be good to you and see that you're satisfied and all that. And that's what free enterprise is all about.
Mm-hmm. So I know the Great Depression really hit the farmers really bad. How did it affect the cattle?
Well,
you were pretty young, do you remember?
Yeah, of course, money was real hard to come by, but it wasn't just a depression, it was a drought that we had. I remember 1931 was a good wheat crop. I don't remember the wheat crop, but I remember hearing about it. Was a good wheat crop, but after that, 32, maybe there was something, but by 34, out here across this pasture, there was nothing there but pure sand. I mean, that was a 2-mile desert right straight up across that. And a cow couldn't eat anything off of that. So that kind of shut us down, and I remember they took a lot of cattle from us, even down to the, what we call the Flint Hills. And at least they had some rain and had some pasture, and we didn't have any. So that shuts you down too. I mean, if you can't get anything for your crop, that's a depression. If you can't even grow a crop, that's a disaster, I think.
Yeah. Do you remember the dust storms?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I remember them pretty well. And I don't remember a specific one, although I do remember that Mom would take in wet rags and put around the windows some to try to keep the dust out.
Mm-hmm.
And you could kind of tell which way the wind came from. If it was black dirt, it came from the north. If it was red dirt, it came from Oklahoma. And it would pile up in great big piles. I mean, just big waves of dirt, or waves, that isn't the term I need. I need just, but like our fences, if we, droughty times, there's a good time for what we call Russian thistles or tumbleweeds. You're probably familiar with them.
Mm-hmm.
And they would, of course, break loose. They will grow with a minimum of moisture where other stuff won't grow. But they'd catch in those fences, and then the dirt would catch in the tumbleweeds. And I remember we had a place up on the south side of our fence where I think we had at least 15 wires in it.
Mm-hmm.
Because the thistles would catch in the fence, and then you would put in some more posts and put more wire on top to get above the dirt. And then maybe the next time you turn around, why the thistles had, I'm talking about over a period of maybe 4 or 5 years, the thistles might have rotted out, and then the wind would start blowing out, and then it'd leave you with your down, and it'd blow a hole out underneath you. So the thistles were quite a chore with fences or anything that would catch in them. Now we have a lot of sunflowers in our fences, and if you happen to have a erosion problem, you don't have the land covered or it sifts a little bit, well, you get a windrow of dirt in your fence.
15 wires.
Mm-hmm, about that.
Wow.
I mean, the thing was probably 10, 12 feet from the top to the bottom. I mean, it wasn't just standing there, but that's what it ended up being.
Wow. Do you remember the jackrabbit drives?
I remember they had them. I remember jackrabbits being real prevalent, but I never was in on any of them.
Mm-hmm.
And we got some jackrabbits now. They say jackrabbits is a sign of dry weather, and I think it was right.
Wonder why that is.
I don't know. Nature has a way of promoting certain things with certain conditions.
Mm-hmm.
It's like grasshoppers. They come some years and some years they don't.
Do you remember some of the prices back in 1930s? Like...
Oh... Not well. I remember a nickel ice cream cone was pretty big, and I remember a nickel Hershey bar was pretty good. Hershey bar, and I think, I don't know, I suppose if you shopped, you could get a package of gum for less than a nickel.
Mm-hmm.
Pack gum, I had 5 sticks to the package, I think. Maybe it still does, probably does.
Yeah.
Tell me about it. But anyway, but that was. Prices. I remember we used to sell eggs. Mom had some chickens, and you'd get maybe 12 cents a dozen or 10 cents a dozen for your eggs.
Mm-hmm. That's a pretty bird. Sorry.
What?
There's a... No, what? It's gone. There was a yellow and black bird I've never seen right outside the window.
That's an oriole. We have. Are you familiar with Baltimore Orioles?
No, I'm not.
You're not? Well, I'm not. Hey. We'll look for him after you get through with this.
Okay. So tell me about going to school.
Well, I started a school in the fall of 1934. That was the first year for the, what we call then the new school building, which they just tore down about 4 years, 3 or 4 years ago now. And when you talked about the Dust Bowl, I remember the janitor and his wife were the people that were the custodians at that time. It only took 2 to take care of the school building then. Now it takes a crew. But I remember them using the scoop shovel to take the dirt out of the place. At that time, the, let's see, what have we got up there? The school was pretty much the north part of town. North of the school, there was about 3 houses, and that was it.
Wow.
And that's the old school where that they just tore down, so.
Mm-hmm.
There was a pretty good shot at the school from the wind and the north wind.
Oh, yeah.
Then I think there was, they had 2 first grades. I think there was only about 30 in our whole class. And as we went through, we gained a few and lost a few, but I think our class graduated 25. And one of the big highlights, as far as I was concerned, in 1936, the fall of 36, well, 37, I don't know. Anyway, when I was a third grader, band director Don Moore came to town. Bert Lane was the coach, and Hink House was our superintendent.
Mm-hmm.
And as I think back on it, that Hink House had to be quite an administrator, because both of those guys were pretty firebrands. And as you've noticed, maybe you've noticed, maybe you haven't, that when you are in music and in athletics, usually one or the other goes. But it didn't in our school.
Mm-hmm.
The football boys played in the band, and they were in the music, and time was made so that you could practice in the band and you could practice for athletics too.
Mm-hmm.
Which they put in a lot more time in practice now, I guess. Maybe we have more professional athletes, so to speak, but I don't know, when you're supposed to be an amateur and you're in it for fun, why you have to be so professional and spend so awful much time at it, I don't know. But actually, when during those first years of the band, so say from 37, 38, 39, 40, in there, the football boys, the band man did make arrangements without the football boys. And I guess when you talk about it, when I was a senior and a junior, the band director had enough clout with the superintendent that we put our pads on, then we put our band suits on, and we went and marched the program before the ball game. But at that time, it was kind of a, well, it was just the matter of the times, but the first chair trumpet player was the quarterback, and the best drummer, well, it's Jimmy Phelps. Maybe you know Jimmy.
Mm. His name is familiar.
Yeah, but anyway, Jimmy was our main drummer, and I was the main trombone, and you pull out your main trumpet player and your main trombone player and your main drummer, and you got a little problem with the band. So, I mean, you know, it worked. It worked. But then as soon as we got through marching the program, then we ran down over the hill and put on our football suits.
Mm-hmm.
And then we played the football game. So it worked. And I think it worked for the best for the band.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, that was school, and we had lots of activities. I don't think we have the activities they have today. Seems like activities are the main thing you go to school for anymore, but maybe that's being prejudiced a little bit. But
I wouldn't say so. But what kind of activities did you do? You had band and you had football and...
Well, we had plays every year. Well, the juniors would have a play, and the seniors would have a play, and then the drama group would have kind of a one-act play system. I mean, that would be the plays.
Yes, could he call you back?
We did have some, we didn't do a lot in, what I'm trying to say, forensics, I guess you'd say, speech and speech contests and that. We did some. We didn't have debate when I was in school. There was a journalism class that did a yearbook, although we didn't have a yearbook when I was a senior. And but they did have a newspaper they put out, the Blue and White, they called it. So that was about it, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
At that time, of course, I guess they have rules now about how many games you have and all that good stuff. But we had probably Tuesday and Friday nights, and That would be about it for games. Football season, Friday was it. In fact, we played some Friday afternoon games. We didn't have lights up here when I was in school. And now it seems like every night something's going on somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
But we didn't seem like they had a little more time for kids to be working or be with their job or be somewhere else.
Mm-hmm.
Or killing time, they did that too. So I guess it gets them off the street if they're busy or something.
Mm-hmm. So when did you graduate from high school? That would have been...
1946.
Mm-hmm. What do you remember hearing about the war, World War II?
It was real, real close to everybody. It's amazing the way the patriotic feeling caught on the whole nation. Everybody was in it too, as a united effort. I mean, it's what can I do to win? It's not what's in it for me. It's what can I do to win? What can I do to take care of this, to protect my nation, to protect my freedom? And of course, it was over by the time I graduated, basically. I did manage to get into the Korean involvement, but World War II, of course, was really, really tough. And I don't think people today realize how critical it really was, or how people really felt about it. I mean, hindsight's always real easy to say, well, yeah, we got through it all right and everything's fine. But when you're in the middle of it and you wonder what's happening next, it's a whole nother ball game. As I remember, you'd hear about, and I'm sure they weren't telling us everything that was going on, because you see it on different documentaries now. But, you know, like the Battle of the Coral Sea, and I didn't realize how many ships they were losing in the Atlantic during that period of the submarine thing. I mean, it was thousands. You know, you stop and think, 1,000 ships, that's lots of ships and lots of guys.
Mm-hmm.
Uh-huh. And so it was real serious, and I think in our day and age, we're prone to kind of discount how serious it really was.
Mm-hmm. Do you remember first hearing about Pearl Harbor? Do you know where you were?
Yeah. Yeah, I was right out here in the yard. It was Sunday afternoon. In fact, I don't know whether it was kind of a cloudy afternoon, if I remember right, or kind of hazy. I don't remember what it was. But I remember where I was and when it happened. Of course, nobody knew what was going on or anything about it.
Mm-hmm. So you had rationing, right? Ration cards? Did that?
Yeah. My mom was always a real good manager, and I, of course, that time probably, what was I? Sophomore in high school, and junior, freshman. I don't know. But anyway, she took care of that, and I never suffered.
Mm-hmm.
The one thing I think I remember about it is the tire thing. You often wondered about it. It's like everything else. I guess the squeaky wheel gets the oil, but some people that really got tires that, you know, we kind of wondered, did they really need them? But that's all right, you know, there were tires there, and they got them, and so that was the way it went.
Mm-hmm.
But we didn't have near the equipment then that we got now, or the pickups or the trucks or anything. We never got a pickup until 1948, 49, I don't know when it was. I was in school anyway. So everything we did was, you pull the trailer behind the car. And if you only got one car, why, it doesn't take a heck of a lot to keep tires on one car. a battery or anything else,
mm-hmm.
except you're pretty well tied up when it doesn't work.
That's true. You said the patriotic feeling of the country was really big and everyone really pitched in. So does that mean you did stuff like Victory Gardens or?
Well, being out here, we had a pretty big garden anyway.
Mm-hmm.
But they did have a Victory Garden in Cimarron, I remember. And, you know, well, a lot of it was for promotion in a sense. I remember I was in 4-H Club, and so we had paper drives. And we go around and gather up papers in our stock trailer, which I guess saved something for somebody, I don't know. But anyway, but if you could feel you were doing something for the war effort, why, you did it. One phrase that came out then, and you probably know nothing about this. Are you familiar with Lucky Strike cigarettes? You ever heard of them? It's a brand that was famous, like Camels and Chesterfields, mm-hmm. Lucky Strike. And at one time in the war effort, Lucky Strike Green has gone to war. The pack used to be a green cellophane or some mm-hmm. kind of material. And then over the radio on the commercials, like Lucky Strike Green has gone to war, which I don't know what it did, or if they saved anything with it, but at any rate, it was probably as much promotional for Lucky Strikes as anything else. But
mm-hmm.
of course, cigarettes are a whole other ballgame now compared to then.
So what other sort of stuff did you do? But I've heard that there were kids that went around collecting. You said you collected papers. Did you collect aluminum or anything like that?
Yeah, iron, old tires. I don't remember how it was done, but I assume it was probably some place in town you'd take your stuff and dump it.
Mm-hmm.
And it's kind of like recycling in a sense. But and a lot of people made things go a lot further. I remember one of the things that came out was the feed sacks that you could make clothes out of. I don't know if you're familiar with that one or not.
I've heard a little bit about it.
Uh-huh. But anyway, supposedly then you could utilize the material for something else besides just a feed sack.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
That would definitely be interesting.
Well, you better have a seamstress in the family if you're going to do it.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know what the material was. I suppose it was cotton of some kind. Certainly, I never saw anybody wearing burlap stuff.
Do you remember where you were when you heard the war was over?
No, not really. You kind of figure things were winding down. And, I mean, it wasn't that big a climax to us. Kind of like out here, a holiday really isn't a holiday. I mean,
mm-hmm.
everything's got to be fed, everything got to be taken care of, so yeah, you do take off and you go and do some things and you make plans to do that, but the cows don't stop eating and the chores are still to do, so if you don't do it, somebody's going to do it, and so you don't just flat take off a weekend and hey, I mean just out of the blue take it off, you plan for it.
Well, you mentioned you got in as part of the Korean War. Were
uh-huh.
you? Can you tell me about that a little bit?
Well, I went to college and then I applied for the officer candidate school, and I became an officer in the Civil Engineer Corps, and so then I was in active duty from Oh, I think it was April of 52 till June of 55 or something like that. And Sean and I got acquainted with the military that way.
Mm-hmm.
And it was real interesting, and I liked the military myself, what I did. I mean, I think life is a matter of attitude, and if you decide you're going to like something, you basically will get along with it. Maybe not like it, but you'll get along with it. If you decide you're not going to like it and it's going to be terrible, then you're going to be unhappy, and you're still not going to get along with it, but you'll be miserable. So you got to kind of think positive.
Mm-hmm.
So that's kind of way.
But usually it takes a little bit to start picking up what's going on. Okay. Thing you liked
about every time,
it.
Every time you went to a base, it had a basic structure. There was always a main guard. There was always a place where they could send you to tell you what you needed to know. There was always a place to eat. There was always a place to sleep. I mean, it wasn't like going to, say, Wichita and then looking yourself up an apartment and doing all that. It wasn't that it was compulsory, but still it was there. And to me, that was a security that I liked about it, because somebody else had been there and done that and it was ready for the next go around.
Mm-hmm.
So that was one thing I liked about the military.
What was kind of the attitude toward the Korean War? I mean, the country had just come off of this 3-year war in Europe and Japan, and how did they feel about?
It wasn't a resentful war like Vietnam became. The people pretty well accepted it. It was a tough place because it was so cold up there in Korea. And of course, the communist Chinese were dumping an awful lot of support into the North Vietnamese, North Koreans. And so it wasn't a matter of you didn't always win. And that was a bad deal about it. I wasn't over there, but anyway, the one thing that did happen was that a lot of people that had been in the World War II had stayed in the reserve, and in the Korean conflict, they called on the reserves an awful lot for action, and a lot of people felt a little bit bitter about that one, in it. But here again, you'd signed up in the reserve. It was supposed to be a something that you wanted to do to protect your country, and they did. I'm not saying that they resented that, but it was that they just called up a whale of a lot of reservists. And from their standpoint, the bulk of them, I'll say this, probably went to college. An awful lot of them went to college on the GI Bill. Out of World War II, that was a real great program as far as getting a college education. And a lot of them went and got their college education, and just when they got their college education, of course they were trying to get along and supplement the best they could, was why they stayed in the reserve. Then they got hauled back in. Well, that was a little rough there, because here you take out, say, 5 years of their life for World War II or four, then you go from 46, say, to 52, that's another 6 years, and then you haul them in that for another 3 years, and they're getting a little age on them by the time, you know, they're out mm-hmm. looking for a career. But I do know a lot of them, they learned a lot in the service. I mean, there's a lot of vocations and skill to be learned in the service, and they put that to good practice, so it wasn't all lost. And a lot of them went to work for the government that I knew, civil service people.
Mm-hmm.
So there wasn't a resentment with the Korean, I don't think, that there was with Vietnam. Although Vietnam, well, there's a lot of reservists got called up there too, but I don't think it was near like the other deal was. I think they felt they learned their lesson in Korea and they were going to try to support their forces with more or less volunteers or that type of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And draft. They had a draft in Vietnam too. So.
So what did you do as part of the Korean War? You said you went from the...
Well, I was in the Civil Engineer Corps, and
mm-hmm.
our part was to... the Navy went out, and the Navy didn't have... Say, they wanted a missile, or they wanted a bomb made. And the Navy didn't have a bomb plant or a missile plant, but... there were people out there that were good at that, like Macon Arms was good at bombs, and Bendix Corporation was good with, they ended up with a Talos missile, which was where I was involved a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
And so the Navy would go to Bendix and say, what would you set up a plant for and operate it here, and we'll pay you to set it up. In fact, the Navy bought the plant, paid for the plant, but the Navy didn't run it as an administrator. They let Bendix run it. And so I was in on looking after the plant maintenance, more or less.
Mm-hmm.
They would build a new plant at Mishawaka, Indiana when I was there. And that was for the Talos missile.
Mm-hmm.
And so I don't know whatever happened to the plant. I suppose the Bendix bought it for 5 cents on the dollar, but
mm-hmm.
maybe they didn't. Maybe the Navy or these government many times put a hold on that. I mean, yeah, somebody could take it and run it for their own stuff, but if emergency came, then they would want it back, or they could take it back, which is reasonable.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, in World War II, they went in and went into a lot of plants and operated them with putting out, say, tanks instead of Studebakers or something like that.
Mm-hmm. Sarah told me about there was an explosion one time at the plant you were working at.
I'll have to think about that one. Must not have, didn't impress me too much, but an explosion.
Well, she said that something had gone wrong and there was just this big deal that you...
One thing that went wrong, in a sense, was, but they just hadn't counted on it, at Decatur, Illinois, where they contracted with Macon Arms to make a bombs. They would make a 500 pound, 1,000, and 2,000 pound bomb. And they had this guy that was pretty, well, he was in the arms business. He knew what he was doing. And he came up with an idea of big electric furnaces. And they start out with a piece of sheet steel about 8 feet square and maybe an inch thick. And they would heat a bunch of different forms, and they'd take that and they'd put it against the steel and get it red hot, and then they would press it, and they'd press it through about, oh, probably five processes, and they'd have the shape of a bomb out of that piece of sheet steel.
Mm-hmm.
Which was a good deal. But one thing they hadn't counted on was to the ventilation in the place. And in order so that the steel didn't stick to their form, they gave it a shot of oil. Well, you give it a shot of oil on red hot iron,
mm-hmm.
and it's gonna blow a bunch of smoke out. And that was kind of like an explosion in that place, I know. It was a pain. Oh, we had a few occasions. One night we went out for a ride on a LST. I don't know if you know what an LST is or not. landing ship tank, they called them. And I know they used to be, they were supposed to be the dream thing in World War II, and that they had great big doors that would open up on the front, and they had a big ramp that would fall down. So you'd run that baby into the beach, drop the ramp down, and the tank would just drive up on shore. That's the way it's supposed to go. And they worked pretty good. Well, they worked real good. I mean, when you stop and think about it. But one of the problems they ended up doing, and they ended up putting a lot of pontoons together. And then you would have a causeway, which is just a pontoon road that you could tie up there, and you could drive in off of it, because jumping a tank off in about 8 feet of water isn't the best, smartest thing in the world either. But anyway, we were out doing an exercise with them one time, and so these things were supposed to be self-sufficient, and each one of these LSTs was supposed to take, I think, around a 100-foot piece of pontoon, and they had an angle on the side of the ship so that that would hook into the pontoon, and they'd go on the outside, outboard edge of the pontoon, pull it up on the side of the ship in order to transport it. In other words, you weren't dragging those pontoons across the ocean. You had them mounted on the side of your ship. Mm-hmm. So they had them mounted up, and they were showing us how it worked, but then they decided that the easiest way, of course, in port was to lift them with a big crane. They just come along with the crane and picked it up, and they were done. But anyway, then in theory, when you got out in the field and you wanted to put those things ashore, you'd get that ship out and turn her wide open, and at the precise moment, then you would cut that pontoon loose, and it would fall, and your momentum from your ship would take the pontoon on in. But anyway, they were demonstrating how you that ship could load that pontoon by itself with cables and pulleys. Mm-hmm. And so they always told us, hey, you want to be careful. The cable might break. Be careful. Well, has it ever happened? No, they'd never seen it happen. But it happened that day. And the cable broke. And I'll tell you, when a cable goes through a cast iron pulley at a high rate of speed, the pulley just flew apart. I mean, there were just pieces of pulley flying all over everywhere. So yeah, that was kind of interesting.
Gosh. Oh, that's crazy.
Yeah, it was kind of different.
Uh-huh.
But that was just one experience.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody's had a lot of them. So I don't know. You probably interviewed a lot of people with a lot of good war stories.
There's been some. I haven't talked to anybody who could talk about Korea.
Uh-huh.
I've talked to several people who knew about World War II.
Mm-hmm.
Like Bryce Ramsey, he talked about that sort of stuff. But I have heard very little about Korea, so.
Well, actually, it was very tough on a few people, but it wasn't, it didn't have the country tied up like World War II did. I mean, it wasn't near that big a deal.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of like Desert Storm and these we have now, you know. I mean, yeah, they're real important to a few people that are involved, but from the standpoint of all the resources of the nation and all that, it's not a big deal.
Mm-hmm.
We don't think it is, anyway. Let's put it that way.
So how long were you in the military then?
Well, I was on active duty a little over 3 years, but I stayed in the reserves and I retired.
Mm-hmm.
So I was in the reserves for, well, active duty and reserves, I think 22 years or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And the thing that I enjoyed about it was that every year I had to go to training camp or couple weeks, whatever, and it gets you away from what you're doing.
Mm-hmm.
It's you kind of just are back with the other people in the world, some of them, So that's what I liked about it.
Mm-hmm. So were you in the reserves during Vietnam?
Mm-hmm.
Were you ever in danger of going over? Or?
Not that I know of. Mm-hmm. I don't think so, but you never know. I did rub shoulders with a few that were. Actually, I was in Alameda, California, taking a course one time, and they flew a couple of wings in there that were reservists that were on their way to Vietnam. I think one of them was out of Missouri. This one boy, his family grew turkeys. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if maybe they still, I don't think they grow turkeys that way now, but then they would put turkeys out to farmers, and farmers would take the turkeys and they would feed them and do all this. And then there was supposed to be a market for the turkeys, and what it boiled down to was cheap labor mm-hmm. on the part of the guy that owned the turkeys is what it boiled down to. But anyway, this guy, family was in, had been in the turkey business a long time, and they had a hatchery too. In other words, they hatched the little poults and then they could send them out and they'd be out with the contractors. So I was visiting him one time, said, "Well, how are you doing?" "Well," he says, "the turkey business out in the field is no good," but he said, "the hatchery's doing real good." So they were doing all right. Mm-hmm. But here he was in the reserves. He was going to Vietnam. Mm-hmm. And I suppose Dad or Big Brother or somebody was looking after the turkeys, which was what he basically had decided he was going to do with his life. Mm-hmm. So that's the way. That's what happens to reserves. And you've heard of them here. I mean, and they pulled them out all over Kansas, I guess. There's units in Great Bend, Wichita, and all that. Mm-hmm. And if they can pull them and get them back before too long, I mean, it's not all that bad. Mm-hmm. But like World War II, where some of the guys were gone for 4 or 5 years, unless you're a career person, then that's a different deal. Mm-hmm.
I'm going to change the subject a little bit. You've been in Cimarron basically your entire life, except for the time when mm-hmm. you... How has the town changed?
Oh, I don't know. It's hard to say. Well, I don't really know how to start with that. We used to always have 2 grocery stores. Mm-hmm. Now we got 1, and thank goodness we have it. Never knew what a convenience store was. Now I guess we've got 2 of those, mm-hmm. which is fine. I mean, that's great. Of course, we used to have 1, 2, 3, 4. Probably 5 filling stations or 6. That's what we call them, filling stations. Service stations. You used to get service at a service station. Now all you do is go in and fill your car up at a service station and pay them, mm-hmm. which is okay. And we did have 2 lumber yards for a long time, and they kind of combined into 1. We did see the big growth in the insurance company, which was 1 little office up until about the latter 40s, maybe 50s, and then they really took off. And that was a big industry for Cimarron. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you heard, but I think they had around 300 in their employ at one time.
I didn't know it was that big.
And that's that pretty good size operation. Mm-hmm. I think they owned or were in about every store on Main Street that was empty. And so how it changes, I don't know. I mean, you grow with the people, and a lot of them are they're all wonderful people. We had back years ago, we had Lloyd Tuggle and Ralph Clark. We had two drugstores. And Mrs. Clark was a wonderful person as far as congeniality and meeting everybody. I mean, for the good of the community, she'd do it. She just was bubbled with that. And I'd say that Sandy Coast is close to that now. I mean, you know,
yeah.
People just kind of fill in the shoes of what it needs mm-hmm. to be done. And, of course, Sandy do believe real well, too, but that's beside the point. So, actually, things have gotten bigger and faster.
Mm-hmm.
I do remember the wheat trucks used to be right down Main Street. That's
mm-hmm.
that's where they all lined up. And they were all maybe 150 bushel, maybe 200 bushel wheat truck. That was the max.
Mm-hmm.
Now the semis come in there. I don't know what they got on them, 800-900 bushel probably. But they're semis and... But they don't park on Main in the middle of Main Street anymore either. But that's where they used to be. And a lot of people even haul their wheat in their pickups. And I don't go back far enough to when they hauled them with horse and wagons, but I guess they did that too.
Mm-hmm.
But things have gotten on a bigger scale, so much bigger scale. When I was probably sophomore or junior in high school, I worked for my uncle at Harvest. And he had some land that had, at that time, what you call summer fallowed about everything. Are you familiar with summer fallow?
Mm-mm.
Okay, well, I'll give you an education here.
Okay.
But anyway, in summer fallow, you grow a wheat crop, you plant it, you grow it, you cut it.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, then you don't do anything with that land probably till fall or the next spring, and you don't grow anything the next year on it.
You rest the land.
You rest the land for a year. That's what summer fallow is.
Okay.
And that was the way things went in this country most of the time. Some people continuous crop, but most of it was summer fallow. Well, in that year that I'm talking about, my uncle had, I don't know what he had, around 900 acres that he had summer fallowed and was going to plant on this one place. And he didn't get any rain, so it didn't get planted that fall. So he double summer fallowed it. So the next year he planted it, and it was a beautiful crop. I mean, it was the best wheat we'd ever seen. And I think it made 31 bushels to the acre, and that was best wheat we'd ever seen.
Mm-hmm.
We cut a lot of wheat that was 15 bushels the acre, maybe 12, and then there was some poor wheat. But now, if you have a 30 bushel wheat crop, you think you're on the doldrums of disaster. You know, I mean, it's got to be 50 or 60 or you're not even in the ball game. So the production has increased tremendously.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, the size of the elevators have increased. Like when I was little, I guess that one elevator over there west was built. It's got 1930 on it, I think. That was when it was built.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a big elevator in Cimarron. Everything else was little stuff. And another thing they did a lot then was to get railroad cars and load them out about as fast as they could get wheat in.
Mm-hmm.
And now you don't see them loading out cars all that much. Of course, they got tremendous capacity now too. So that's a whole another gamut of what we have here. The roads through town have changed a little bit, but that's I remember when 50 was a through street and 23 had to stop. You always stopped there. There was no stoplight. And I don't think Fifth Street even existed when I was little. So. But that's one thing that's changed. That courthouse, it's changed. We've put additions on it and so forth, but it was built in, I don't know, 27, 28, somewhere in there. So it's been around quite a while, the main building. So some buildings last, and the old opera house, I think it was there in 1912.
Where was that?
Upstairs over Clark's.
Wow.
They had traveling shows that would come in and put on programs and all that kind of stuff. Of course, everybody'd go because there was no movie. There was nothing back in the 12s and 15s. Then the movie was that we had in town sat in the building where, is it Joni Addison?
Jane Addison.
Has her beauty shop now. And that was where we had our picture show. I remember that from about the mid-30s up through quite a ways. I don't know when they quit finally.
Did you go to the movies a lot?
No, I never did. When you were out here, you didn't go a lot. I mean, you just weren't that mobile. I didn't get a car till I was a sophomore in college, or junior, for me. The folks made it available some, but, you know,
right.
When you got one car in the family, that's kind of the way you run it, too.
Yeah.
Is that your car out there?
No, that's my dad's van.
That's dad's van.
Becca has the car that we share.
Uh-huh.
My sister, so.
Well, at least we have a car to share.
Yeah. Well, that's about all I have. If there's anything else that
I can't think of too many things. I should have given it more thought, which
it's okay.
I didn't do. If Sarah listens to it, she can tell me what I should have said. And you can come back and get a sequel to it.
Okay.
Maybe.
We'll see what we can do.
Okay.
All right.
One thing that has changed, back in the 30s, there weren't any trees hardly on the river.
Mm-hmm.
In the 40s, then the trees came and they about choked the river off.
Mm-hmm.
And then in the 70s, when the river went dry, and 80s, then the trees died. So now you can see back across the river some. But I remember laying in, I was pretty sick, I guess about the first grade. They thought I had measles and something, but I ended up thinking I probably had scarlet fever, but I was pretty sick, so I would lay in the bedroom and I could look out the window and look over across the river. You could see the trains go and see the cars go, and then it got to where you couldn't see anything, just trees. Now you're back where you see trees, cars. So I guess what goes around comes around sometimes.
Yeah.
But that's about all I can think of right now.
All right. Well, thank you very much.
Well, thank you for coming out.
Really appreciate it.